Chapter 4, Eureka Arcade. Unable to believe his luck, Sean found himself being escorted back to what he had to assume was Shopliftitian's dwelling. No sooner had he sat down in the shabby workshop which doubled as his residence than did a group of 5 young people, 2 women and 3 men, come storming in. "Hi," Sean said in the high spirits he was still boying around on. "Hi," echoed some of them repeatedly and teasingly back at him. "For someone so close to being skinned, you must be feeling pretty full of yourself, Shopliftitian," one of them sneered menacingly. "Who are you? Or should I call you Sean?" "Eh? Eh?" The Multimoch did another round of the intruders.
"Oh, come on. Who do you think you're fooling?" asked the tallest boy.
"Well, everybody, except you, obviously," replied Sean at a loss.
"Just what do you think you hope to achieve by this impersonation of a perfectly respectable goldsmith?"
"He's a thief," replied Sean.
"We're all thieves."
"Yeah, just not as good at it as we are," said one of the girls, who was trying on some jewellery she had found somewhere on a side bench. She came over to Sean and caressed his cheek with the backs of her fingers. "Feel how light my fingers are? Poor, poor Shopliftitian. He would have been all right if Archimedes had not chosen this precise moment to reveal a great secret of science to the world, wouldn't he?" She pouted demurely, then laughed at her own cleverness. The boys picked up the mock. "Poor, poor Shopliftitian had to pay the first price of progress."
"Who are you?"
"No, the question is, who are you?"
A boy pushed Sean into a chair, then slumped himself extra boredly into a facing chair and put his feet on the bench right next to Sean's head.
"Well, until today, I was Sean Solpierre, of the year 2010, Lugano, Switzerland. How do you do?"
"How do you do?"
they mocked back with creative intonations of derision. The other girl stepped up to Sean and extended her hand, picked up his, shook it, and put it back down again.
"My name is Jenny. Jenny? That's right. We are time riders."
"We ride the big time waves," the shortest of the boys boasted,
as he jumped onto a workbench, put his arms out and swayed around like a surfer. Jenny continued reproachfully,
"You have some explaining to do, Sean. Changing history is one of the big no-nos."
"The biggest no-no," said the tallest boy, using his height to tower over the seated Sean.
Sean felt the tone become more threatening.
"But I had to save myself from being flayed alive."
"That's nothing compared to what is going to happen to the fabric of time," the taller boy continued.
"Fabric of time?"
Jenny was cross now with her friends.
"Don't, pal. Stinto, get down."
Then to Sean, "He invented that. It is nothing at all like a fabric." "It helps monos understand," said the tall boy, his lips taking on a cruel, superior smirk.
"Monos?"
Sean looked from one to the other.
"Monodirectionals, like you.
At least you were until you appeared here."
"Monodirectional? As in time?"
"Sure, what else?"
The boys all seemed to think everything Sean said was highly mockworthy.
"Knock it off, guys," said Jenny. "He's just confused and lost, poor boy."
"Poor boy,"
mocked the boys again.
"You mean," replied Sean, "you can travel in any time direction you want?"
The small boy was now showing off.
"Of course. It's easy once you understand what time really is."
"So," went on Sean, "do you have a time machine?"
"A machine? Why would a machine help us travel through time?"
"Then how do you do it?"
"I told you, by simply understanding the true nature of time."
"Tell him about the fossils, pal,"
joint boasted the surfing boy.
Jenny now took charge. "That's enough. Sorry, we shouldn't have just burst in on you like this. Time for introductions." She indicated the tall boy. "This is Pow.
And this is Stinto, the surfer.
And little Elf."
She brought the by now even more self-bejeweled girl over. "And this kleptomaniac is Amor." Sean blushed when he saw how beautiful the girls were, especially Jenny. The boys, too, had something wonderfully fine and noble about them.
"Your brothers and sister?"
"In a way. We are time riders."
"Nothing, since you said hi, has made any sense at all," admitted Sean.
What do you understand, Sean? Non-dimensionality? Spherical maths? Sneered the boy called Powell. A little bit of new maths? Why?
Tell him, Powell,
chorused the two other boys. Powell thus condescended. Everything can be seen and understood in two ways, like the two sides of a coin. Amour continued for him. When you time travel, you have to be able to see the truth about time. Otherwise you are left with a monocosmic perspective, and that won't do at all, no, not at all. Amour put on a necklace and admired herself in a polished bronze plate. Now Stinto took over. Time travel is all about geometry. Get that right, and you can go anywhere. For example, the quickest way from Europe to China is through the core of the Earth, true? Elf answered him. Yes, but if you can't pass through the core, the quickest way is around the surface. Wrong again, Mr. No-Go, Stinto replied. If you can just detach and stay still, the Earth will rotate beneath you. You don't have to take the hard route of forcing yourself through the atmosphere.
What a drag, Powell broke into their routine, and the three boys collapsed, laughing at their own cleverness at Sean's expense.
Jenny walked over angrily and punched Powell in the upper arm, clopped Stinto in the back of the head, and missed Little Elf, who scampered just in time out of range. Then she came back and continued the explanation to Sean in kinder tones. What we're saying is, if you don't restrict yourself, you can free your mind to all sorts of other possibilities. By never assuming anything's impossible, said Sean. Jenny beamed at him. That's right. Very good, Sean. Are you saying you don't travel through time, but you let time pass you by? You stand still and just find yourself in another time?
Like surfing the big ones,
and Stinto began his Beach Boy act again. But only the consciousness travels. You are occupying other people, just as I'm occupying Shopliftitian.
Bright kid, this one, said Powell.
Do you really mean that? Counter-hoped Sean.
Cause he doesn't. You're a dumb mono, isn't he, Powell?
Laughed Elf. So what's he doing 2,222 years out of place? Asked Amour. Sean was struggling with the concept still. But how? Aren't we dragged along at the speed of time? Jenny answered him. Time has no speed. It is not moving. We are. What you have to do is realize time is only a trick of the eye, an interpretation of the observer, not some sort of fixed framework hanging in the universe like your mother's curtains.
Powell said, There is no wards to move to.
No by to tick away from, unhelped Stinto.
It sometimes helps to think of time as a river in the Spenmat, concluded Jenny.
Spenmat is short for the cosmic background of space, energy, matter, said Powell. Follow me?
Not in the slightest. Think of the Spenmat as the projector and screen for the film of time, said Jenny. Reality is what we think of as a fluid film. But is in truth a series of nearly identical frames, giving the illusion of fluid movement.
Now, ask yourself what happens when the film projector jams, said Powell maliciously.
See this? Elf held an egg-sized piece of polished rock out to him before Powell could stop him. Sean took it and gasped, It's my rock egg! He looked at it more closely, a one just like it. Jenny said, It's a very special egg. It's a piece of inverter rock, and it contains a very small amount of ancient fossilized time. Just a couple of chronons, tiny fractions of time interval, but in super-condensed liquid form and enough to trigger a jump.
Wow!
Sean held the small rock tightly and squeezed his eyes shut and imagined his home, Mammy, Pappy, Nonna and Shrody. He opened his eyes and was disappointed to see he hadn't moved. The boys sniggered cruelly. So how does it work? Amour answered, Not like that. First, you have to make an omelette. Break it? Well, let's go. Sean lifted his hand and prepared to smash the egg. Powell seized his arm and prized the egg out of his grip and gave it back to Elf.
No, you don't. This is not for you. Only one jump per person per egg. Get your own.
Where from?
Not telling. Please.
Jenny sat in front of Sean and took his hands gently in hers.
He liked her best of all.
You see, Sean, your coming here is not right. As a mono, you shouldn't be able to do this. And as a result, you have upset the historical record.
Stinto added, Before we let you go home, you have to put things back the way they were. Powell said cruelly, Archimedes is now discredited, thanks to you, and his theorems about maths will be lost, putting the world back centuries, if the priests have their way.
If not forever, said Elf in a faraway kind of voice.
They all think he's an old git, thanks to you, said Stinto.
Jenny finished the group explanation. That will have unknown consequences for the future. You have got to re-establish Archimedes in the eyes of the people here, so his discoveries will be safely imprinted in the historical record.
Sean sighed as he recalled his last image of Archimedes, shuffling sadly down the road, while a flock of children ran after him, calling, Dad hate Nadi, and other taunts. This, he decided correctly, was not going to be easy.
On his way to Archimedes' house, Sean noticed that someone had daubed over the name of his street, replacing it with a taunting Eureka Arcade. Sean found Archimedes looking as anyone should when he knows he has just missed the last chariot to immortality by the narrowest of margins. I've come to apologize, he said to the old man. I should not have humiliated you. I should have let them find me guilty and flay me alive.
Quite right. There are principles of basic decency at stake here.
Listen, Master Archimedes.
You can call me Archie.
Right, okay, listen. Archie, you are not a head of manure steam, as everyone is saying.
And this is supposed to cheer me up.
Okay, let's start again. You are, I promise you, destined to go down in history as one of the greatest mathematical geniuses of all time. You give the world the beginnings of the language of the gods.
Oh, do I? Quite frankly, I'm thinking of retiring. I find my style of calculating all too exhausting, and so do my staff.
He indicated several assistants, panting in a securities heap around a table covered in diagrams, clay tablets, and measuring instruments of various types.
Not another calculation, master, they begged.
Why are they so tired? Asked Sean, amazed.
I use the method of exhaustion to find the lengths of lines that describe circles.
How does that work?
One team measures by drawing as many lines as possible touching the outside of the circle. A second team does the same, but on the inside of the circle.
Why two teams? You could economize there, suggested Sean, staring at the workers, furiously drawing lines and dissecting them again and again.
That's the point, murmured Archimedes. If you can't know exactly what something is, the best thing is to know exactly what it isn't. The exact answer is between the two totals when the teams sum the lengths of their little lines.
And what do you call this technique?
The method of exhaustion.
I can see why, observed Sean.
This way we can put precise limits on how wrong we are. I was hoping it might kickstart some new fashion in philosophy, but the accountants in the marketing department of Eureka Moment Industries sank the proposal on previous experience grounds, market surveys, etc. They tell me uncertainty is unlikely to ever sell as well as certainty.
Sean stopped Archie and said, Okay, I can do at least that for you. Got anything to write with? Archimedes took a large notebook of animal skin parchment from a shelf. Yeared Sean, wrinkling his nose. What's that?
I'll have you know this is the finest abattoir stationery money can buy, huffed Archimedes, as he chipped the clay price tag off the back showily. Try this imported quill from over the far eastern mountains, he said, handing Sean a fine white feather.
You get your pens from China? Sean was staggered.
Sure, airmail delivery.
In 212 BC? That's not possible.
Why not? The geese fly over, we pluck them on arrival.
Archimedes sniffed one.
Go on, they're fresh.
Okay, now, Archie, the value of pi is 3.141.
What do you mean by point a number?
Archimedes pointed his index finger at the sequence, as if he expected something would happen.
Ah, okay, you don't have decimals yet, but you have fractions. You can also describe pi as this sequence. Sean took the parchment and quill and wrote, pi over 4 equals 1 minus 1 third plus 1 fifth minus 1 seventh plus 1 ninth, etc., 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 and yet again, etc., till he looked like those guys there, except perhaps slightly bluer in the face.
What's it for?
It is pi, the ratio between the cross-section of a circle and its circumference. Rather than jubilant, Archimedes looked entirely fallen in the way crests can only do.
But the sequence goes off the edge of the page.
Yes, forever, admitted Sean.
You mean there is not enough flat parchment in all the known world to describe the simple ratio between a circle's aroundness and its acrossness? That sounds distinctly irrational to me. Both of our techniques can still only approach the true value, can only be an approximation. This means the fundamental ratio of all celestial movement will always be a complete mystery to man. Are we destined to be uncertain forever about the true nature of the universe? Destined never to speak to the gods?
But Archie, you teach the world how to handle this uncertainty. Your technique will be the inspiration of the celestial language. You are the creator of the language of the gods.
You mean Spiki Celeste has been found?
Asked one of the measurers, who had been dropping eaves throughout the conversation. Well, not yet, admitted Sean. But in 2,000 years, when the Enlightenment comes, thanks to Archie's teachings, men will be able to divine great things about the movements of the universe, design machines, and calculate all motion and relationships with extreme precision and ease.
Tell us about that, complained the outspoken measurer.
Who is that? Asked Sean.
John. We call him John the Measurer. He is also our chief scribe and photocopier.
Photocopier?
Sure. Makes photo or visual copies of my notes. It's slow work. He does it the old way, chiseling basalt or deluxe porphyry slabs, if he can get them, in 3 languages. He says hard copies last longer. I'll get him to make a copy of this notebook. And he has theatrical ambitions, this John the Measurer. He is leaving soon for the theatre festival in Rosetta, Egypt, to launch a comedy he has written about old men on the home front during the Second World War.
You know about the Second World War? Sean stunned back.
John replied as he chiseled the mandatory ISBN, in situ basalt number, onto the back of a large pink porphyry slab, ready to start the copy of Archie's notes.
Well, sure. Technically, it should really be called the Second Known World War, a sequel to the First War currently doing a tour of the Mediterranean. The season keeps getting extended. The Romans call them the Punic Wars, which is a pity because all the kids keep chiseling my N's to B's on the promotion slabs. It's a classic plotline. Army meets army, army defeats army, everybody left lives miserably ever after. It is due here in Syracuse any day now. Everybody's dying to be involved. Should be quite a hit. But I'll be missing it, since I have to sail for Rosetta in Egypt.
What about the stone copy of my notes? You promised,
pouted Archimedes.
Oh, that's okay. I'll finish it on the voyage, said John.
Here,
said Archimedes, handing him Sean's digital watch.
You'll need this to finish the instruction manual.
So the Second Known World War is why you have to make a death ray? Sean asked Archimedes.
Not really what I had in mind. I figured some special lighting effects might add something to John's show. I didn't realize my suggestion would be taken so life-to-death seriously by Adrenodorus and his friends. Honestly, they get everything wrong. They thought my Archimedes screw invention was a new fiscal instrument.
Okay, said Sean, remembering his mission. Got your quill ready? We have got to re-establish your credibility. How far have you got with the death ray?
Not meeting expectations. Even with hundreds of mirrors, they can't even raise enough heat to cook a Syracusan donkey burger. And believe me, with an exhausted team to feed, I've tried and tried.
And you've had no success at all?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. See that moor at the end of the table?
Yes.
It didn't used to be one.
I can see a few problems with this design. What if they attacked in the rain?
Yes, that would put quite a damper on the idea. We'll just have to ask them not to.
My design is more waterproof, Archie. I'm going to build you a death ray to be the mother of all death rays. It is called a laser. It will burn holes in the enemy ship so fast the sailors will be looking for a dock without the K.
Sounds good. What do you need?
A lot of volunteers.
They come by the shipload called slave boards.
Okay, 5,000 should do it.
A whole half a myriad? That'll be expensive.
Slaves work for free, surely.
If only. They tell us slave supplies are low due to some poor war spoil harvests. We will have to get them on lease through one of those dodgy Magna Graecia import agencies.
I'll leave that to you, went on Sean. I also need a large amount of poor conductor. You obviously don't have plastic, but glass should work just as well.
Oh, we have lots of that, made from sand. There is a factory bulk discount outlet right here in Syracuse. The glass-making district is called Silicon Alley. A sand tanker from the Sahara Desert is due any day.
Okay, we also need 5,000 woolen jumpers, so get all the grandmothers of the town to start knitting. I'll do the rest. Where can I find some copper wiring? Archimedes thought for a moment, then said,
Try the lads at the Ye Olde Bronze Age Metal Merchants. They are a little old-fashioned now that everybody is moving over to the new fad of iron, but they do a good job on order.
But I need copper, not bronze.
No problem. Just ask for bronze wires and say, hold the tin.